Tomas.
Yes.
Did you know there are killer electrons in space?
No, but you're getting me worried. The science basement.
Hello and welcome. You are listening to the Science Basement podcast, a podcast of people who love all things science. I'm your host, Eleana.
And I'm your co-host, Tomas.
And today we are talking about killer electrons in space. Our guest is Harriet George, who recently defended her PhD thesis at the University of Helsinki in the Space Research Group, and soon is starting her first postdoc at the Laboratory of Atmospheric and Space Physics at the University of Colorado in the US. Welcome, Harriet.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
And we are very excited for having you here. And I have to say, I am already very intrigued by the title you gave us. So you have in the title the word killer electrons in space. So what exactly are these killer electrons?
Killer electrons are a very high energy type of electron. They can actually move very close to a speed of light and can be very, very damaging to people and satellites, potentially even killing these very important electronics on the satellites.
I'm from outside of physics, so just sort of recapping a bit, what do you mean by really high energy electrons? I would have thought that they were simply particles, like very small particles that make part of atoms. So how would these electrons differ from other electrons?
So in space, we can actually get our electrons outside of the neutral atom. So we get them whizzing around just in space generally. And these free electrons can get to very, very high speeds. So moving so quickly that they are at speeds comparable to the speed of light.
Okay. That's really, really cool. And how do we get to find these electrons? Like, where are these killer electrons hiding?
So I look at a specific region of space called the radiation belt, which is very close to the Earth, where we get a very huge number of these very high energy killer electrons. So this would be just above the atmosphere and much, much closer than the moon. So really the closest part of space that you can get to the Earth.
So you mentioned this term, the radiation belts, but for the people in the audience who are not from the field of space research and might not be very familiar with the term, could you briefly describe exactly what they are?
The radiation belts are a collection of particles that have gotten stuck in the Earth's magnetic field. So the Earth has a big magnetic field, the same shape as a bar magnet, but on a much, much larger scale. And then just huge numbers of particles get trapped in here to form a donut-shaped region or two donut-shaped regions around the Earth. So there's the inner belt, which has a lot of protons, which are those positive charges inside the atom. And then there is the outer belt, which is mainly made up of electrons. And this is where we find those very high-energy killer electrons.
And okay, so just to recap the image, we have these very fast electrons whizzing around the Earth. Why are you calling them killer electrons? Like, you mentioned that they can be damaging to satellites, but why are they so dangerous? Like, how can they pose a threat?
In the same region around the Earth that we have the radiation belts, we also have a huge number of satellites orbiting in the same region. And these very high energy electrons, if they have high enough energy, can get through the outer layer of the satellite, the shielding on the outside, and directly damage the very delicate electronics within the satellite. And this is incredibly dangerous and damaging for the satellite. A very good example of this is actually the GPS satellites. These are on orbit. That means they're always inside the outer radiation belt and always being exposed to these very high energy killer electrons. So these are some satellites that we have to be very careful with to make sure that they don't get damaged by these dangerous electrons.
So this kind of damage sounds very expensive. Do we have estimated costs, and what does it mean for us?
Yeah, so it can be incredibly expensive if a satellite gets destroyed, but it really depends on how many satellites get destroyed and what they're being used for. Our GPS satellites, for example, are used for a huge range of things, like making our phones work and everything like that. So if these satellites get very badly damaged or even destroyed and need to be replaced, and then all of the follow-on effects that we use these satellites for also get disrupted, that could be incredibly expensive. But there are also less important satellites for our day-to-day life that could have a less expensive effect on our society. So it really depends on what exactly happens and what satellites get affected.
Right. So if I understand it also very well, although maybe I'm not being very honest by saying that, because I am from this field of research, so I have a bit of knowledge on these things. But of course, as you said, if a satellite gets damaged and has to be replaced, that will cost a lot of money. It's not easy to build them. Equipment costs money. Shooting them up in space costs also money. That was a very weird way to say launching a satellite. Sorry. But I can also imagine, as you said, that because they affect our communications, because our phones, communication and navigation systems depend on that, this has the social impact you mentioned. And I always like to imagine myself being out in the forest here in Finland where I live, picking up berries and having wandered around from a path. And then I'm like, oh, I need to find my way back to the car. Let me use my GPS. And then I'm like, oh, no, it doesn't work. And then I'm stuck in a forest in the middle of nowhere in Finland. That would be very, very scary. So we talked about the damages these killer electrons can do to satellites. But can people in space be affected by these radiation belt electrons as well?
Yes. So the radiation belts can also be very dangerous to people too. And it's something that we need to take into account when we send astronauts into space to go to the moon or to Mars, for example, that they are being protected from these very dangerous electrons. And this can be things like sending them on trajectories through the radiation belts that expose them to fewer of these very high energy electrons, or sending them fast enough that they only get exposed to them for a very short period of time. Another case where this can be very important is for the International Space Station, because we always have astronauts on the International Space Station. And this actually had to be put in an orbit such that it was at such a low altitude that it was below the radiation belts. Because if it was higher up, it would orbit and pass through the radiation belts and potentially get these astronauts on board very sick and expose them to very high levels of radiation. So it can be very dangerous for people as well.
If I might intervene, what ways can we find to protect people? So the only thing that I can say with confidence in this podcast probably would be that, I mean, the way that that these electrons can damage cells is by hitting mostly DNA or some other biological molecule and causing damage. The problem with hitting DNA is that later on it can lead to cancer or some other disease like this. So is there a way of shielding people from this radiation, or how can we protect our dear astronauts?
Yeah, so something important that we do here is that we make sure that if there are conditions in the radiation belts where we get lots of these very high electrons, the astronauts stay inside the spacecraft, inside the International Space Station, and are protected by the shielding on the space station and aren't out like doing a spacewalk or something like that. And that helps to protect the astronauts.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's good to know that we can at least do something to shield them a bit.
Yeah, so long they are inside, they are pretty safe. Harriet, you mentioned that the International Space Station is placed in an orbit that will ensure that the astronauts are not exposed to the radiation belt particles. But is that always the case? So are they always safe from the radiation belts?
As far as I know, the International Space Station is always closer to the Earth than the inner boundary of the inner radiation belt. So I think those astronauts on board are always safe. It's more of a concern for when we send astronauts away from the Earth to the Moon or Mars or something, that we need to be very, very careful that they are also protected.
And does this belt move? Like, is it a ring? Is it like a ring around the Earth, or what shape does it have? And does it, I don't know, like, could it be something like a halo situation of it moving around? Or yeah, like, how, if we were to dye this belt, like, how would it look like in the sky?
Yeah, so the radiation belts have a very donut kind of shape. So if you imagine the Earth in the donut hole, the thick part of the donut would be at the equator. And we've got one donut, which is the inner belt, and that's mostly protons. And then further away from that, we've got a bigger donut with a bigger donut hole, and that's the outer electron belt.
Is it stable at the equator, or does it move in any... in any direction? What if we put a satellite outside in a stable orbit? Yeah, if people don't know, you can put a satellite at what is called a geostable orbit, so it'll go around the Earth at roughly the same speed. So if you put a satellite there, would it still be in danger from the belt?
Yes, so that geostationary orbit is actually inside the outer radiation belt. So those satellites on those stable orbits are always being exposed, or the vast majority of the time being exposed to those high energy electrons in the outer belt.
So now we kind of made it clear so far that it is very important to protect the satellites because of having some of them spending most of their lifetime in the radiation belts, or some of them occasionally being exposed to these killer electrons from radiation belts. And we also talked that also humans in space could be affected by these hazardous electrons. But what can we do to protect them?
There are a few different ways to look at this. From an engineering perspective, you want to develop new materials and new spacesuits and everything that can protect the satellites and the people there. But from a science perspective, I think that the most important thing to do is have a very, very thorough understanding of the radiation belt environment, so that we know what these electrons are going to do. We know when they'll reach these very high energies. We know how they get to those high energies, and we can predict what they do next.
And how are you contributing to this knowledge? Like, what is your research about?
In my doctoral research, I was studying the transport and loss of electrons in the outer radiation belt. So we can broadly understand the overall dynamics of the radiation belts as a combination of acceleration processes that get these electrons to the very high energies, transport processes that move them within the radiation belts, and then losses that take them out of the radiation belt environment altogether. So I've been focusing on the transport and loss of these particles.
And how do you lose one of these particles? Sorry for the dumb question, but I would have thought that, I mean, you obviously don't know exactly where each is. So how do you count and lose an electron?
Yeah, there are two main ways that electrons can be lost from the radiation belts. So the radiation belts are formed by particles getting stuck in the Earth field. But if they get too far away from the Earth, the magnetic field of the Earth is much weaker than the background magnetic field in the solar system that forms like the solar wind and everything. So when the particles get too far away from the Earth, they get swept away by this much stronger solar wind and are lost from the radiation belt environment. The other way that particles can be lost is actually by getting too close to the Earth. So they can actually fall into the atmosphere and react with chemicals, molecules in the atmosphere there. And this means that they're also lost from the radiation belt environment.
So we talked about these particles getting lost from the radiation belts, either when they come very close to what's beyond our magnetosphere, and that's the solar wind and the interplanetary magnetic field that originates from the sun. And also we talked that they can get lost when we talk about very close to Earth. But how often does that occur?
So we always have some background level of loss just because we've got these different acceleration, transport and loss processes always happening. But there are different events that can cause these processes to have a much, much greater effect. So there are big explosions on the sun that release huge amounts of material that can travel through space and whack into the near-Earth system. And when this happens, they can drive absolutely massive changes in the radiation belt environment. And that includes knocking huge amounts of particles, huge amounts of these electrons, out of the radiation belt environment. So that can cause massive amounts of loss of radiation belt electrons.
We talked a little bit about this loss of electrons and what can cause them to get lost, like the solar storms. But you also mentioned that you research the transport of electrons. Would you like to expand a little bit on what exactly that entails?
Yeah, so I'm looking specifically at a process called radial diffusion, which moves the particles radially towards or away from the Earth. And the way that people normally study this is they use a theory that assumes that any changes in the radial location are very small and take a long time to happen. So most people look at radial diffusion with small changes on long timescales. But one of the projects I did during my PhD was applying a different kind of theory to develop a methodology that could look at radial diffusion that moved particles large distances quite quickly.
And what did you find, if you don't mind me asking? Is the method that you were using slightly better or more accurate, or how does it help us understand the movement of these electrons or the loss of these electrons?
Yeah, so this comes back to those big solar explosions that I mentioned. So when the material released in these explosions hits the Earth system, they can drive very large, fast changes in the radiation belt environment. So we need to have a theory for radial diffusion that can have big, fast changes in the radial location of the particles. In my research, I was purely focused on developing the methodology, which was quite difficult and took a while. But I'm very confident that when we apply this methodology to see how the particles respond to these kind of very large disturbances, we'll get much more accurate results than with the old theory that has small, slow changes.
Oh, that's really exciting to hear.
Thanks.
It has been indeed very interesting to hear, Harriet, both about your own work on the transport and loss of the electrons from the radiation belts, but also what does that mean for our society and our space endeavors. So if you wanted the audience to take one message home with them, what would that be?
So I think the really big, exciting thing that I'd like people to take home here is that the radiation belts is actually incredibly dangerous, and they're so close to us as well. We have so many satellites and potentially soon quite a few people traveling through the radiation belt environment that it's so important that we really understand this very dangerous environment in order to properly protect our people and our technology.
This is a very nice message, and it's also something I always like to advocate for, and that is that any kind of research might not sound like it has an immediate application for the society and might be more fundamental in terms of its focus, but it still has a longer contribution, or like a deep contribution to our society, sustainability and in development. And it's very important to highlight these things, because in order to be able to carry out this kind of research, we need funding. And the funding decisions comes from governments, and governments are voted from the people. So it's very crucial to pass the message to the society. So I'm very happy you mentioned that, Harriet. And maybe we can wrap up the interview with what is the next step on your research plans, and also on radiation belt research in general?
Yeah, so next year for my postdoc, I'm actually going to be moving away from the radiation belts a bit. I'm going to be going all the way over to Venus to look at how the space around Venus interacts with the solar wind, that material flowing through the solar system. I think for radiation belt research in general, our next step is going to be building more and more accurate models so that we can predict what the radiation belts are going to do. And that really ties back into that big overall question of being able to protect our satellites and our people as they pass through this environment.
That sounds really promising, and I am indeed looking forward to the upcoming research on radiation belts and hopefully to forecasting and also protecting from killer electrons from radiation belts. And I wish you good luck to the next steps, and I will be following up on your career in the future, and hopefully our paths will cross again, because for our audience who might not know, I am in the same group as Harriet, so we have known each other for a little while, and I am sad you are leaving us. But before we close this episode and we move to the fun fact that we always have at the end, we now have a new segment running for a little while in our podcast episodes, and that is questions from our audience. So one of our listeners, Rhiannon, is asking, do these killer electrons only exist in space?
Oh, that's a very good question. So I've only looked at these electrons in space, but I think that it could also happen in other situations. For example, in nuclear explosions, you would get very high levels of radiation, and those electrons would also be killer electrons as well.
Yeah, and imagine like in those explosions, they're pretty close and we are not far from them. Okay, that's an interesting answer, because when I first read it, I was also a bit trying to think, what could the answer be? So thank you for solving that mystery. And I hope Rhiannon is happy as well. And without further ado, Tomas, what is your fun fact?
So my fun fact for the week is that rats are ticklish.
Rats, yes, are ticklish. Okay, what does that actually mean?
To be ticklish?
No, I know what it means to be ticklish, but I mean, tell me more about that and why. Is a research that found out about that?
There are actually many theories as to why, like, animals are ticklish, but it's been found in other species other than humans, and we think that it has to do with socializing. So basically, we don't know. There are many different hypotheses. One might be that it's like for help us train with how to survive, because usually you're ticklish in very vulnerable areas.
That's true.
But people don't know why essentially we laugh, but at the same time, the feeling that you get is quite aversive. So like nobody really enjoys being or like seeks being tickled, but it's also really related to play. Mm-hmm. And so this is sort of the general part of like, okay, why the background science going behind, but it actually does have a sort of direct application, if it makes sense, because it's good for rat well-being.
For what?
Rat well-being.
Okay.
So there's a lot of research going on rats and they're used in neuroscience. And because of ethics, we want rats that are in research to have good lives. And that sort of understanding of what makes them feel well and their social behavior has been going on to ensure that they have less stress and that the researcher can build a good relationship with their rats. So this is why it is, the reason why there's research on rats being ticklish is to ensure rat well-being in research.
Okay, now I'm a bit confused and impressed at the same time, because as you mentioned, we don't usually like to be tickled. I'm sorry, I'm still carrying a bit of my cold in this interview. But yeah, as I was saying, we don't like to be tickled, but also others like to like, you know, tickle someone. So it's to me, it's always more of like the social interaction that we always like to put other people in a vulnerable situation. I found it very rude when people try to tickle me, but I do admit that I have attempted to tickle other people too. So I find it very interesting that it helps the well-being when it's something we usually tend to, you know, be a bit not offended by, but a bit annoyed by.
Yeah. No, but it helps build social bonds. If you think about it, I mean, I wouldn't recommend going and tickling a stranger, but it's when you are starting to know someone, and usually when you're in the position of tickling, like it's that sort of play that comes into it, and you do it a lot with children. Again, do not tickle strangers' children, but if you have, I don't know, a niece or a nephew or something like that, that you can borrow, it's that sort of game play situation that comes into play. And yeah, we see that it's really important, and we actually do see it in when humans do it to rats as well. So they become, it's essentially playing with them, and they become more accustomed to you, and they show a lot less stress.
So you're bonding with them.
Yeah, exactly.
I see. It's very funny, because I have a small observation to make. I used to tinkle my parents' dogs, and they would always take their paws away from me, because I knew like it was their paws that they were more tinklish about, so they would take it away from me. But when I do the same thing to my cat, she just spreads her little paw beans and she's like welcoming the little tickle there. So it's very interesting to hear that. I won't say I'm surprised that other animals tickle, but it's very interesting to hear it. How what do you think about that, Harriet? Are you ticklish, or did you ever try to tickle your pets?
I've never tried to tickle my pets, but I've tickled my siblings a fair bit. And they I had fun.
You had fun. I don't know about them.
But yeah, so that is my fun fact.
That is indeed a very, very interesting fun fact. Thank you very much, Tomas. And thank you very much, Harriet, for joining us for this episode. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. And honestly, good luck with your future career.
Yeah, it sounds very exciting. So good luck.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you. Bye-bye.
No, bye. The Science
Basement. If you liked this episode, give it a thumbs up, rate us on the podcasting app of your choice, and don't forget to share it with your friends. This podcast was produced by The Science Basement, a science communication organization based in Helsinki, Finland. Interested in getting involved or being interviewed? Get in touch at podcast@thesciencebasement.org.